I was asked to make something non-technical, and I really tried. This fine plate. But well, let me try without notes first. So I want to talk about pure spinners, beta gammas. And Simons and supriangles. As you can see, they all end with S, so that's one thing they have in common. And this is all about string theory, of course, so which begins with S. So
which starts with S,
which is a natural. So. We have several perturbative string theories, or at least we have beginnings of them. And it is usually formulated as the fact that the superstrings have several formulations. But I'd like to propose a somewhat new viewpoint, which is that we actually have different string theories which are dual to each other. So we have the RNS string, Green-Schwarz. We have topological strings, and we have pure spinner, which will be capturing the best of each of them. So I don't want to put it on the blackboard yet. Why do I say these theories are different? Well, to begin with, the RNS string, if you think about it in old-fashioned terms as of some kind of sigma model coupled to Wolfschmidt gravity or supergravity, so that describes super surfaces embedded into the bosonic spacetime. So here the target is just the ordinary spacetime, ordinary manifold, no fermions in spacetime, but the Wolfschmidt has some superstructure. The Green-Schwarz, on the other hand, studies bosonic surfaces, which are embedded in the superspace. And the topological strings, in a sense, at least in most of the applications, they describe bosonic surfaces, which are embedded in the split supermanifold. So this is the manifold where the supermanifold where the fermions are just living in a tangent bundle, and they are sort of scalars from the Wolfschmidt point of view. Now, if you read, if you open any textbook on string theory, you'll learn that these theories are equivalent. And if you think about it, this equivalence, if we think about this in modern terms, we should view it as some kind of a t-duality. Because if you want to map the Wolfschmidt variables of the RNS string to the Wolfschmidt variables of Green-Schwarz, namely those which describe the odd, the fermionic directions in the super target space, you use non-local operators on the Wolfschmidt. So you bosonize fermions and you write some spin operators, something which is similar to what you do when you describe t-duality, when you map momenta into windings and vice versa. So it is some kind of a t-duality, and the reason we don't call it t-duality is because it happens in fermionic directions only. So recently people started to talk about fermionic duality, but I think they should have started talking about it in this context first.
That's why there's also no piranha.
And since it's a fermionic, so since these directions are fermionic, there is no parameter except that in some sense, well, I would like to say that to think of this as here you have a uncompactified fermionic directions. So the R is equal to infinity, the radius is infinite. And here it's zero. So this is why you don't see fermions in time space here, and you see a lot of them here.
Some value in the classical concept, we look at classical world cheat actions and perform some switching.
Well, I don't know if there exists a nice transformation which maps the action, the world cheat action, preserving all symmetries of the RNS guy into the Jim Green Schwarz. What I'm talking about the standard thing, that if you want to construct the space-time fermion in using the RNS variables, you use spin operators. So
it's more like SOE tryout.
Which is also kind of.
So I think this makes sense in light language. I'm not sure it makes sense coherent.
Well, I mean, you can read some, so if you can write some formulas which look correct, but maybe not quite correct, which say that, for example, theta alpha, the Green-Schwarz fermion is something like, you know, something like 5 by 2 or something like that. So this is a non-local in RNS. So, okay. And then, there are topological strings, which they have various manifestations. But one of them is that if you study the so-called physical superstring compacted Python Calabi-Yau manifold, and then you're interested only in a particular set of vertex operators. So, namely, if you take on Calabi-Yau. And then you just turn the zero momentum gravity-photon vertex operators on R4. So you have Calabi-Yau across R4. Then this is equivalent to a topological, critical topological string on Calabi-Yau only. So what goes on here is that somehow the ghost, the super ghost, and then these four dimensions, and the fermions which describe the bosons and the fermions which describe the R4 direction, all together, after certain non-local transformations like bosonization, fermionization, act as if they just twisted the Calabi-Yau part of the Siegel model and twisted the two-dimensional supergravity into topological gravity. So this is another kind of a similar, it's another kind of fermionic T-duality, fermionic bosonic T-duality. So here, actually the part of the bosonic space-time got sucked up into the transformation, so we lose R4. In that sense, it's a similar phenomenon. And the end result looks like it looks like a bosonic string theory except that the big ghost is a composite, so the stress energy tensor is always a BRST commutator, QBRST commutator, but what is a commutator with is a composite operator, and so it's constructed out of a supercurrent on the wall sheet. Now, so these old theories are nice for various purposes. So RNS is, if you look at it in the conformal gauge in the flat background, it looks like the Wolchi theory is free. And formally, at least, you can define the prescription for the amplitude calculations on any genus, except that you very soon run into trouble of the following nature. So since I'm not giving a technical talk, and I don't know all the technical details, the problem is that you're supposed to integrate over the supermoduli space. So you have Riemann surfaces, but actually they're super Riemann surfaces. So they have bosonic moduli, which we're all familiar with, 3G minus 3 Hadronic moduli and 2G minus 2, or depending on spin structure, fermionic moduli. Unfortunately, this space, it's one of the supermanifolds which do not look like the simple split kind of supermanifolds, which are just some fiber bundle over the bosonic manifold where you just change the statistics of the fiber. Instead, the ordinary moduli space sits there as a submanifold, but there is no canonical way to project from the supermoduli space to the ordinary moduli space. So when people say that all you have to do, you have to integrate out the fermionic moduli first, and then you end up with standard looking integral over 3g minus 3 complex parameters, it may be true, but technically it's quite complicated. And depending on how you choose this projection, you may get into various difficulties with the apparent gauge dependence of the answer, of how you choose the slices in choosing this projection. I don't know if it is a fundamental problem. I don't think it's a fundamental problem. But given the fact that probably 20 years have passed since the first surge of the activity in that direction, and the recent activity of people like Docker and Fong was still confined mostly to the cases where this problem actually does not arise, suggests that this is something which is worth worrying about. Now in Green-Schwarz, so this is a kind of, you can think of this as a kind of a technical problem for defining higher loop amplitudes, and then after all you could try to reconstruct them by unitarity. But another problem is that if you formulate this theory in the background, which is space-time supersymmetric, the supersymmetry is not manifest. So, which has to do with the fact that the transformation to the manifestly supersymmetric formulation involves non-local transformation on the Wolfshield. And therefore, if you want to turn on the Ramon-Ramon fluxes, any non-trivial backgrounds involving Ramon-Ramon fields, this is quite complicated. So in Green-Schwarz, the problems with apparent supersymmetry, the manifest supersymmetry, are gone. And moreover, if you could solve the Wolfshield theory, the end result will be beautiful, because all you have to do is to integrate over the modular space of complex structures, because you began with bosonic surfaces, nothing else. And to finish here, in topological string, it actually works. And despite the fact that this the BRST partner of stress energy tensor is a somewhat complicated composite operator, people did manage to compute or at least make plausible conjectures about the results for any genus for the amplitudes of arbitrary higher genus, and in a sense confirmed many expectations about the factorial growth and things like that of this amplitude.
Correct me, those were done by very indirect methods, right? In this all loops is alpha logically typically obtained by dual, not by...
No. In the old days, what people did, they actually managed to analyze the integral over the modular space of Riemann surfaces, indeed by making some tricks like taking the large volume limit, which is an error parameter. The integral measure localizes near the sort of collapses to the locus where the Riemann surfaces degenerate and start looking like trivalent graphs, and then you get some field theory, perturbation theory, and then so you can analyze this field theory. Of course, this is not the end of the story, because that field theory it's a six-dimensional field theory which is non-Riemannizable, and there are many other things, but nevertheless. People did computations for hilariously large values of genus, so which goes far beyond what is known in QCD. Okay, but if we are going back to the general story of physical superstrings, the problem is that the Green-Schwarz Wolfshield theory is nonlinear. And more, what is worse is that if you try to just quantize it, you immediately face the second class constraints. And if you try to which are intertwined with the first-class constraints in the fashion, which is, once you try to disentangle them, you break manifest Lorentz invariance, and it becomes ugly. So, this is why the pure spinners are useful. So pure spinners is a kind of approach which I'm really embarrassed to speak about this in the audience, where many people just were at the birth of them. So I just invented this approach, but I'll try to present things in a way which you probably would not recognize. So maybe my excuse for doing this. So in some sense, pure spinners, they are like twisters. Now I'm going to upset another half of the audience. So what are the twisters? Well, twisters are a smart way of translating the standard equations of motion, let's say mostly for massless fields in various dimensions, which are typically second order, into reasonable first order equations, which have some interesting properties. And so let me start with something very trivial, like a free boson in two dimensions. So we have a free boson in two dimensions, which solves the Laplace equation or the Lambertian equation. Well, the solution is the sum of two chiral parts. One is left moving, one is right moving, which we all know. But now let me view this as a very non-trivial thing. It's a sum over complex structures compatible with the metric. I don't know how it appears. Of a function which is holomorphic in this complex structure. So in two dimensions, basically all your choices are whether you choose the standard complex structure or you choose the opposite complex structure. Okay, so that was trivial. So of course, if you add by Laplacian on that, you can always rewrite Laplacian as a product of d times d bar or d bar times d, and one of them will always annihilate the summon here. So when you act on the Laplacian on that, you will get zero for one reason or for another reason. Okay, this is something which everybody knows. Something which is perhaps less known is that you can do the same similar thing in four dimensions. And that is a little bit less obvious. So let me take a solution of Laplace equation in four dimensions. Let me take the simplest, the Green's function, 1 over r squared. Now, in four dimensions, I want to represent it as a sum, or rather as an integral, over the complex structures. Again, compatible with the standard metric. So in four dimensions, the space of such complex structures is a two-dimensional sphere. It's S2. In fact, I'm slightly cheating because here I didn't pay attention to whether my orientations are compatible. But in four dimensions, I fix one of the orientations, and so it's, in fact, the space of complex structures are two spheres. But let me just pick one. CP1. And so if U is my coordinate on CP1, then I can define holomorphic coordinates in the complex structure U roughly as Z1 plus U Z2 bar z2 minus u inverse v1 bar. There is a formulation where you actually use both u and u bar, but here I'd prefer to have things holomorphic. And then what you do, you just take the counter integral, du over du, So for each value of u, this is it's a meromorphic function of the appropriate holomorphic coordinate. Now you can write the Laplacian as a combination of d and d bar operators, and you can write them in any complex structure u. So this is true for any value of u. So when you act, it will be zero. But if you take this integral by residues, if your contour is appropriately chosen, and the twisted people choose some integral contour, then you actually will precisely get 1 over r square, which is 1 over z1, z1 bar plus z2, z2 bar. So what it means is that at least at the level of equations of motion, the second order theory with the Lagrangian phi box phi in four dimensions comes from some theory with the first order action, what we call psi d bar psi, in six dimensions, where so it's roughly R4 cross CP1. If you compactify R4 to, let's say, 4 sphere, then you can make a nicer space like CP3 or something. So this is where twisters come in some sense, that these are these extra variables which parameterize a choice of a complex structure, maybe some other extra geometric data, which allows you to translate the second order equation, here it's a Laplace phi equals to zero, to the first order equation, d psi, d bar psi equals zero. And of course, the most famous application of this technology is in the construction of instanton solutions, where
is there a relation between psi and phi?
Yeah, so the relation is that it involves taking this integral, right? So psi depends holomorphically on this varying complex coordinates, and it may also have some dependence on u. If you're describing not the scalar field, but let's say spin one field, then it translates to some particular dependence on u. And then you just take an integral of that kind. Or in more sophisticated cases where you study non-abelian gauge fields, for example, this psi will be a matrix, and this integral will generalize to something more sophisticated, like you have to decompose into the product of one matrix which has an expansion at u equals to zero, another matrix which has an expansion at u equals to infinity, then you take the product. So, but in simplest case, it's just
it's also reminiscent of the Bessonian retention science.
Well, it's a little bit different. Well, maybe there is some point of view that the poles of the meromorphic forms should be viewed as a boundary of space. It's like a complexification of the notion of the boundary. So in standard correlation between Chern-Simons and Bezumino, you have Chern-Simons in the three-dimensional bulk and Bezumino in the two-dimensional boundary. But here you have something like a six-dimensional or three complex dimensional theory, which is related to a two complex dimensional theory. So it's a complexification of the relation between Chern-Simons and Bezumino, which we are familiar with.
Expressions for z1u and z2u, correct? It looks like.
Maybe they're not correct. I was told to be not technical, so you're welcome to correct any typos. But they, morally speaking, they're correct. So when maybe I want to put u minus 1 here, and that's what you want to do. If u goes to 0, then this term, you can neglect this term, and this term is much more important than that term. So it's something. Well, anyway, so it's a nice exercise. It's simple to fix this. It's easy.
This is also reminiscent to the action of Tychomorphic on the CMAP. So you also view this as sort of
And of course, it's called
Hypermalt. Well, it's, I mean, Hypermalt, when we, this is not unrelated, because in whatever, whenever you deal with hyperkähler structures or even quaternionic structures, it's always useful to view them as fiber one, so to fix some complex structure, and then Sergei's remark is about the matter multiplets in n equals 2 four-dimensional gauge theories, but you can view them as n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theories, but you can do it in many ways, because there are many n equals 1 subalgebras and n equals 2 superalgebra, and they're precisely parameterized by this U variable. And this is how the many things are written. In fact, the way to write the action for hypermultiplets involves this kind of integrals. This is not accidental, but okay. So what are the pure spinners which Nathan uses in his in construction? I mean, I'm sure his motivation was different, so maybe it wasn't different.
I mean, for Paul Howe, used them before me, and it is a direct generalization of what you said. So you start with n equals 2d equals 4,
yes.
Is kind of the...
Okay, so... anyway, so... So let me try to now to bring them into the game, starting with this problem of second-class constraint. So when you describe, let me discuss only the open streak on the left moving sector. Well, when you write the Green-Schwarz action, if you typically use the manifestly space-time supersymmetric expressions like this one, which so here this is, so we're describing the map of a bosonic wall sheet into a superspace with coordinates x and theta, so x is our 10 bosons and thetas are 16 scalar fermions, they're scalar on the wall sheet, and you have some expressions like, well, this is absolute value squared, and some other terms, like some Lezmina terms. So as you open the brackets and you try to find out what is the kinetic term for the fermions, you find out that, unlike the bosons, for which the kinetic term eventually becomes just a standard second order action, for the fermions, the situation is different. So you have what you see is that the momentum for the fermion is proportional to the fermion itself, and also proportional to the derivative of the boson. So you can phrase it in terms of the constraint, saying that if P alpha is a canonical momentum, theta alpha, so theta was a scalar, and this guy will be the 1-0 form. You try to write the action in the form P alpha d bar theta alpha, then this P is subject to the constraint which I'm afraid I will make a mistake in writing. Well, maybe there's some. There are some coefficients here which I will not write properly, like 1/2 and 1/8. So the constraints are these: that this is equal to 0. But since you have a constraint which says that momentum is proportional to the field itself, these constraints are unlikely to commute among themselves or close up. In fact, if you compute the Poisson brackets, even classically, what you will find something which is proportional to the supersymmetric momentum. So it's not the end of the world, because of the Virasoro constraint, which says that P pi is light-like. In fact, half of these guys, so this matrix is degenerate and has half of the eigenvalues are zero. So half of the constraints will actually commute and the first order constraints, so we can treat them in a standard way. In fact, what they generate some gauge transformations, which is the famous kappa symmetry. But then the other half have a non-trivial Poisson bracket, and so it becomes messy. And what is really messy is that the choice of this half is not universal. It depends on the frame, so it breaks Lorentz invariance. So these twisters, so these pure spinners. Okay. So the idea is to introduce extra variables which will actually parameterize this choice of the first class constraints. Let me pause a little bit and give you another example of the situation where just the fact that you have a second class constraints motivates introduction of extra degrees of freedom to make the problem treatable by the standard methods of first class constraints. Suppose you have a standard quantum mechanical system with variables P and Q, which have a standard Poisson bracket. And for some reason, you want to impose the constraint that both P and Q are equal to zero. So how do you do that? Of course, in this reality, there is nothing complicated about it. It's just say P and Q equal to zero, throw them away. But what if you want to do it in an intelligent way? Well, introduce extra variables. Let me call them P prime and Q prime. And instead of P equals to zero, Q equals to zero, I want to replace this by the constraints which actually happen to Poisson commute. So if this is H1, this is H2. So now you have a first class system, and so you have constraints, and then you have transformations which they generate. And this so the constraints will kill half of the variables, and then the transformations which they generate will kill the other half. So the end result is the same, but now it's obtained using the first class variables. So here, the idea is to do something similar, vaguely. And so choose some auxiliary spinner, lambda alpha, which is bosonic, which is in some sense the analog of P prime, Q prime. And now adjust it in such a way, which is similar to adjusting the signs here, plus and minus, that these guys will Poisson commute, and in fact commute. Well, this gamma matrix is still there, so the problem which you have is this lambda gamma lambda. So if you can set this to zero, then this will be consistent system of constraints. And then by averaging over all lambdas, just in the way we averaged over the choice of complex structure in the example with free bosons, in some sense, you will exhaust the whole set of constraints which you wanted to impose to begin with. So this is why you couple your theory to the extra degrees of freedom. So extra target space, extra degrees of freedom. Okay. So what did we get? Well, we got the free bosons. Have a canonical action for the fermions and the momenta. We need some action for the pure spinners. And then we'll impose the constraints by saying that the physical states would be in the cohomology of the BRC operator of that form. Okay.
This is really analogous to what you just erased. I mean, here you have like product of lambda d and then iterated like sum of p and p prime.
So lambda d is the actual thing which, well, these are actually currents. So when I spoke about Poisson brackets, I actually should have spoken about the OPEs. But the actual, you see, the constraint is like you want q annihilate the states. So now think of lambda for the moment as of an independent field. You just allow it to vary any way you like, except that it has to obey this this constraint. Then it's effectively what you're imposing a d-alpha vanishes. Once you impose that, then basically you substitute back p alpha from this expression, and after some manipulations we'll get the Green's ones.
No, I guess I'm trying to understand the analogy that you erased.
Yes.
Is there some BRST charge?
That's the BRST charge.
No, I mean
for the p prime.
Oh yes. So in that case, I should have introduced the fermions, the fermionic ghosts, which would be the partners of the translations in the p and p directions. Or I could have introduced the gauge field. So in Lagrangian formulas, I could have just introduced the gauge fields for p and for q.
And what would the BRST charge be?
It would be something like C times C1 times H1 plus C2 times H2. One tricky point is that my constraints there were bosonic in this example. The constraints here are the fermionic. So there's one extra thing which goes on, that these lambdas are, in some sense, they are the bosonic ghosts for the fermionic constraints. And the unusual feature, which again has to do with the fact that we don't, I mean, our intuition about the super directions is not always, does not always work, is that these bosonic ghosts can have constraints imposed on them, which is this pure spin constraint. Yes?
This seems very general. So suppose I want to do this in a different dimension than 10. Is it any relation between this and the fact that the central charge should vanish? So
there are other there are other conditions which we need to impose that we actually get a conformal theory. So there are several constraints which I mentioned. So if you don't do it in the right dimension where the numbers of degrees of freedom will match, then you will have troubles at the level of central charge and other.
I mean this constraint is quadratic, and
yes,
in the example you gave it was not quadratic, so
no, this constraint or that constraint.
The lambda.
So this is not a constraint. From the point of view of the original system, it is not a constraint. This is a constraint on the ghost. So it has
the condition is quadratic.
Yes.
So this is different from the.
No, that was because the analog of that you can easily find in the. If instead of the constraints H1, H2, which generate translations, you got something which generates rotations, then those are generated by quadratic expressions. So that is not important, I think.
So I don't think there's anything.
But I mean, the fact that this is a quadratic constraint, of course, is not accidental, because in some sense, this comes from the fact that gammas are the structure constants of a supersymmetry algebra. And so this there is some structure which is related to the Bjerregaard homology of the super Poincaré algebra and things like that. But I don't want to get there. I just want to, you know, one step like that. So we get
in the case of four-dimensional bosonic massless field.
Yes.
So the lambdas are the analog of the U.
Yes. Guess. Right.
Is there some space that incorporates the bosonic space if you start working in this extra?
Right. Yes. So what is lambda? So let's pause and think about what do these lambda parameters? What do they contribute? Well, it actually turns out to be quite a natural space. So let me start with four-dimensional case. Then U parameterized the ways to identify R4 with C2. So R4 is a Euclidean space, but you can identify it with a two-dimensional complex space in many different ways. So U is a way to parameterize it. So this lambda in 10D, what it does, lambda parameterizes the ways to identify R10 with C5 plus a choice of a holomorphic top degree form. So there's one extra data which is some number A times DZ1 DZ5. So here we have an extra information. In principle, in this theory of twisters, it could also be introduced. It's just as U parameterizes, the U corresponds to the so-called projective twisters, and lambda, we take it as it is at its face value. We don't divide by the rescalings of lambda. So if you parameterize, if you choose some parameterization I will explain what it means. This is something. Then U parameterize the identifications of R10 with C5, and lambda plus is the scale of the holomorphic top degree form. So U, there are so there is one lambda plus, and there are 10 U's here. So the space of pure spinners, what its geometric meaning? It's just the space of the Calabi-Yau structures on R10. So the Calabi-Yau structure is a complex structure and the choice of holomorphic top degree form. You've heard these words many times in discussions of the topological string. There, people discuss the complex moduli of the Calabi-Yau and the choice of a holomorphic 3 form. Not surprisingly, these notions reappear now that we are dealing with the 10-dimensional backgrounds. So what this suggests is that this formalism, once I finish writing it down, the action, will have something to do with topological strings, but now not on Calabi-Yau 3 folds, but on Calabi-Yau 5 folds.
A is a constant.
This is a constant. It's not a holomorphic function. What is going on? Think about this R10 as of the tangent space to a 10-dimensional manifold. So everything happens locally.
Why is not there a similar form in the four-dimensional example?
There is such form. So you can multiply. So it's just that this U is the analog of that U. So if you choose, if instead of a U you choose the actual spinner in four dimensions, it will also normalize the holomorphic two form, which is also important.
So maybe A plays the role of both problems, so don't think of it that way. Or in four-dimensional
space,
it's projected
right to
the form.
This is a bad notation. Let's just put a lambda plus squared, I think, actually. There's the way to get this geometric objects is you take a pure spinner, you take a pure spinner, you multiply it by a bunch of Gaia matrices, and then they close with the same pure spinner. So that gives you either zero if the symmetries are not appropriate, or it gives something. And so the simplest thing is to take a product of five Gaia matrices and nine symmetry.
Why don't you just choose square root of omega instead?
Good point. So half forms are also interesting, but we usually discuss. Well, I think in the computations of the amplitudes, it's actually integer powers of omega which appear, not. Well, he just wants to ask what is the meaning of lambda plus itself. It's normalization of the square root of the holomorphic top four. And when you discuss quantization of the space, it's the half form which you get usually as a wave function, because when you multiply two wave functions, you get a measure. And so the wave function itself is just the half form. Which is not accidental, because the spinners are also kind of wave functions, so it's all natural. All right. Nathan wrote this action for the pure spinner. So you just take a first order sigma model, the simplest possible action, which makes this extra variables. If instead of the sigma model we were discussing just the particle, then what it just means is that your wave function has the extra dependence on the lambda parameter. But there is no Hamiltonian which is associated with them, with these fields. Now, what does it mean? So, I plan well. What is my upper cutoff?
4 plus, that's everything.
Okay. Everything. You mean everything? Okay. So what is this? You can ask. What is this? So lambda is something we discussed. It's a bosonic spinner which solves this equation. So you can think of this as it sits in some space. So you see, lambda has 16 components. So you have a 16-dimensional complex 16-dimensional space in which you have a bunch of quadratic equations. So what they define something which has a conical singularity. So it's a kind of conifold, generalized conifold. The standard conifold which we normally talk about in the context of ADS-CFT and applications of geometric transitions sits in C4. So this is the usual conifold. The same picture, but totally different physics. Because this is a Calabi-Yau threefold, one can actually write a metric, which is Calabi-Yau. And this is described by a single equation, sum of dy squared I equals from 1 to 4 equals to 0. And there are two ways, in this context, there are two ways to define string theory on that space. Either you deform So make the equation look like that. And so you will find that you've got this. You've grown a three-dimensional sphere of radius epsilon. Or you can do, well, you can do many blow-ups, but there is this minimal thing which you can do, which is the small, which is called a small resolution. So you can, I don't know how to, let me draw it different. You can actually grow a little small two-dimensional sphere, and this is deformation in the Kähler direction. What it means is that you can rewrite this equation in terms of some projective coordinates. Let's say you call z2 equals u times z1. No, sorry, I should look at the problem. You take z1 plus minus iz2, call them z plus minus, z3 plus minus iz4, call them w plus minus. So then the equation looks like that. And then this two sphere parameterizes, let's say, the ratio of z plus over z minus. So you allow them both vanish, but you keep track of at which velocity, in what relative velocity they vanished. And so you end up with having a small sphere sitting at the base. So this is also, both the complex deformation and Kähler deformation are smooth, Calabi-Yau, non-compact manifolds. So in principle, the signal model is well-defined in these spaces, and you can study it. So now that I told you that we want to study the signal model with the target space, this cone, the question arises, how do we create the singularity?
What is the deformed equation?
And you can, so this equation remains the same. It's now the rule of the game with these coordinates, which has changed. You see here. The difference is that, so this space cannot be described by a single coordinate system. So what happens is that we introduce two coordinate system, let's say z plus u, and then z minus will be z plus times u.
I mean, this plectic reduction picture is probably the most efficient one.
Yeah, but well, I don't want. I don't want to introduce z bars. I just want to say that you. Let's see. So you declare that the ratio of z plus and z minus is now a good coordinate. And so in one coordinate patch, this is a good coordinate. In another coordinate patch, the inverse is a good coordinate. So you allow them vanish, but you look at the way they vanish. So the ratio remains finite. You can describe it as a quotient, as a symplectic quotient of C4 by the action of U1. So you have four fields, let's say, four coordinates, A1, A2, B1, and B2. You have a U1 symmetry which acts with the charges plus one, minus one. You impose a constraint, moment map equation. Right? Equals some number r. That's the Kähler deformation parameter. And then you divide by the symmetry. So So I start with four complex variables. I impose one real equation, and I divide by one real symmetry. So that gives me a three complex dimensional space as a result. And now, if R is positive, then A, both A1 and A2 do not vanish. They never vanish simultaneously. And so there is a minimal sphere. So there is a, in terms of these equations, there is a locus where B1 and B2 vanish. You have a three-dimensional sphere, which you then divide by U1, and that gives you CP1, which is sitting here. So the CP1 is the locus where B goes to zero if R is positive, and it's the locus when A goes to zero when R is negative. And then the relation of these coordinates to these coordinates is something like Z plus is A1, B2. So you just try to form all possible gauge invariant combinations. Z minus is A2, B1. W plus is A1, B1. And W minus is A2, B2. Maybe with minus sign. So then, as you can see, the product of these guys is equal to the product of those guys with the minus sign. And that's the Carnifold equation. So this equation holds for every value of R. So what can we do with pure spinners? Well, one unfortunate feature, or actually fortunate feature, is that if you try to complex deform, then you drastically change the space. Unlike this case of a simple Carnifold, where you don't change the dimension of the space, and in fact the deformation does something very little outside of the singularity, here you see you're imposing 10 complex equations on 16 variables. So if you are if everything is in generic position, you should get something which will have dimension 5. But in fact this space has dimension 11. So it means that these equations are not really independent. Five of them are independent, and the other five are not independent. And this is somehow the payback for using these variables to make the choice of the first class constraints covariant in this Green-Schwarz story. Here, if you try to view this space of pure spinners as a smooth manifold, you need to choose five equations out of 10. But that you cannot do, again, in a covariant way.
Okay. The equation which you wrote is inconsistent.
So this what it means is, this is called, I think it's called non-flat deformation of this is not a complete intersection, but what Andre's question is, what happens if I impose this equation? I just kill half of this space, basically, because I will get something five-dimensional. Of course, this will break my rotational invariance because that requires a choice of a vector.
Suppose you work in also complex conjugates to them.
Yes.
So then
it's all homomorphic. So I'm talking about. So
suppose you don't. Suppose you. The same epsilon.
Okay. So if epsilon is real, it's fine with me. Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. But it doesn't solve the problem. It still kills the half of the space. So, you see, what I'm trying to say is that this deformation is most likely. If we manage to define a single one, it's a homomorphic theory corresponding to a single one like space, this will not be a marginal deformation. And if it's not a marginal deformation, then we better not use it to define our theory. So this option seems to be out.
You could perform complex varieties without algebraic.
You can, but you can. So you should do it in a.
You can't use the equations this way.
Yeah. Well, you can use them, but you have to use the relations among the.
Yes. So it becomes
you have an overdetermined system. So now you need to enumerate the relations and then deform that ideal.
Right. So in fact, the richness of the pure spinner theory, of this whole theory, is related to the fact, is ultimately related to the fact that these are reducible equations. So this is not actually, it's not a problem, it's actually virtue. In fact, well, I don't know if I will have time to...
Isn't that ideal rigid, actually?
I don't know if it's rigid. I have no idea.
Is it rigid?
The singularity?
Yeah. You can blow it up. So that's...
That's the other option.
Yeah, that's the other
option.
So if I still want to deform it, but...
You can write this equation.
...in an algebraic way, that's what...
Oh, if you want to lose the fact that it's an algebraic variety.
Yeah.
He's asking the question. I mean, there are rigid singularities. I don't know if this is
one. What do you mean to deform it in a way that's not algebraic?
No, for example, so we know in the example which we all know is the example of K3 manifolds. So the K3 manifolds, you see, if you're given a complex manifold, there is a theory which tells you how many complex deformations this space has. It's some cohomology. There's some cohomology. This is Kodair-Spencer theory. You can compute the relevant cohomology group. So for K3s, you have what, 20?
20
deformations, of which if you write the K3 equation, K3 variety as a quartic in CP3, it has only 19 parameters. So you have 19 parameters which leave you within the world of algebraic varieties, and there is one which is not algebraic. So what Sergey is asking is, for this manifold, what is the relevant cohomology group?
What's the number of marginal?
The problem is that this question is ill-posed, because for my technological abilities, because this is a singular manifold, so I don't know what kind of cohomology I should be computing.
It's not. I mean, there are ways in algebraic geometry of answering the question: what deformations does it have? There's a thing to compute, and if you're telling us that nobody's made the computation yet, then maybe somebody will.
Somebody will. But I'm pretty sure that the answer is zero, actually.
Okay.
Pretty sure that the answer.
Is there any structure on this you want to preserve, or do you just want to add an algebraic variety?
No, of course we want to have, so the most important structure which obviously ruled out this complex deformation was the symmetry under the Lorentz, the SO10 rotations. So this space was acted by SO10, so it's in fact it's an orbital of the rotation group. It also has an action of C star, which it has a conical structure, but which rescales it. So, if you put epsilon there, epsilon breaks this invariant, breaks the SO10 invariant. Because it's a vector. It's a vector. Yeah, but if it's fixed, then you break SO10 down to SO9 or something.
No, but you were arguing with a problem because epsilon has 10 components, but lambda gamma lambda only has 5 constraints.
Yes.
But if I impose lambda gamma lambda equals epsilon and lambda bar gamma lambda bar equals epsilon.
That means that you're imposing a particular case of these constraints where this vector which you chose has some 5 random components non-zero and 5 components zero. But
it's real.
Do you want to impose lambda?
Maybe just 10.
Equals lambda bar gamma lambda bar. Is that what you're trying to say?
No.
Just 10 real components. Okay, so it has 10 real components. So.
Yeah, so
it breaks SO10 invariance. You can assume it has only one non-zero component, but once it has not one, this is the orbit. So the actual orbit of SO10 is the space of projective spinners, where you divide by the action of C star, which is a projective space, which is a smooth actually projective space, and so that is the orbit. What is called you take a spinner representation, and you just take the orbit of a highest vector. So this is a cone over SO10 over U5. And you see, SO10 over SU5 is the space of SO10 over U5 is a space of complex structures, and this extra one complex line is the normalization of the holomorphic top degree form. What I'm arguing, so, and there is a singular point when this top degree form vanishes, and that's what I'm discussing now. This is a kind of special point.
You can blow up, right? That's what you want.
So let's discuss that option. So what if we blow up? What does it mean? It means basically that we just take this space, which is a compact manifold, and then consider a line bundle over it. So it means that we replace that space by some kind of a. It's a line bundle over SO10 over U5. To each point in this projective space, you assign a complex line, and now they don't intersect. So here they all intersect at the point when this guy shrunk to zero, but on the blown up space, they do not intersect.
But you still have an action on SO10?
Yes, of course, SO10 X on it, there is no problem.
So you have a statement just about orbits of all the gray groups, that you have an orbit which doesn't have conflict information, but has.
Yeah, so it's a projective scalar variety, so it has some, I mean, it's all its cohomologies are of PP type, so it has no complex deformations, of course.
Well, it used to be hyperkeler, and it's funny because.
Why it's hyperkeler? Well, it cannot be hyperkeler because it has 10 complex dimensions, so it cannot. Oh, it could be hyperkeler, but I don't think it's hyperkeler.
It is. All orbits are
hyperkeler. No, the orbits of complex groups are hyperkeler. This is a compact SO10.
But haven't you worked on with numbers
were complex, so this is a complex representation. So that's just the fact of life that the spin representation of SO10 is complex. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what's the result you get SO10 by U5?
So this is a compact manifold. It's
but
a compact.
You had a cone over there.
And then you have a. So here you have a cone over it. But here I have a. It's a complex cone, yes. And here I have a line bundle over it.
It's just the contraction of the zero section of the.
So here I have a cone over a CP1, if you like, and
that's about C2.
Here it's the special thing that you can have a small resolution. You could have done just the total blow up, where you would get a line bundle over P2. But P1 cross P1, if you like. Yes. So
SO4 is, of course, reducible. It's not simple, which is sort of the point. I mean, you could interpret this whole thing as that's from coming from SO4, but it splits into two pieces, which is why you get this.
In what sense it comes from SO4? Sorry. I mean, this guy?
Yes.
Yes.
Good. And then the total blow up would be the construction that you're doing now.
Yes.
Not the small resolution.
Because SO4 is a product, then you'll get pure.
That's right.
So this is what we could have done, guided by this analogy. But then we have the problem of the sigma model being well defined, because it's not. We are now talking about a special kind of sigma model on that space. And so let me spend some time discussing that. So I'm saying that this option will also not work eventually. But let me just explain why. Which is, if you think about it, it's probably a good thing, because it means that there are not many choices in defining the ingredients of this construction. So if you're just guided by the simple consistency conditions and symmetry requirements, it's basically unique.
I don't know if this is going to be equivalent to what you're about to do, but in this previous case, the reason for not blowing up the origin the full way is that the resulting space is not Calabi-Yau. Right. And it's only that with those small blobs that you ended up with Calabi-Yau. Maybe what you're about to do is sort of equivalent to that, because this 5-manifold is no longer a Calabi-Yau.
So you see that I mean the fact whether this manifold is Calabi-Yau or not depends on the kind of line bundle I'm taking over it. So in principle, the line bundle which I get at the face value will not be Calabi-Yau, but that could be fixed by taking an orbifold and twisting it. But the problem will bite us at a different point. So there is a different kind of anomaly. But there are two problems. That manifold has to be Calabi-Yau, but it also has to be the so-called string manifold. And that is more serious. Okay, so let me try to remind you what this symbol means. Yes?
Why does it have to be Calabi-Yau in the first place? Because it's a B model or something?
So. This is not B model, but it has to be Calabi-Yau for the reason which I will explain now. Suppose you have some complex manifold, like this one, or maybe smooth one, with some local coordinates which I call gamma I, and you want to define a sigma model of that kind. So beta I will be the field of spin 1,0, and gamma is just a scalar field. So this is just the simplest, the free theory, except that for some reason I say that I is the index which labels coordinates on some manifold X. Well, you can view this as coming from the ordinary sigma model, or maybe supersymmetric sigma model, in several ways. So suppose X is scalar manifold. Like these manifolds we're talking about, they're all scalar. Then you take a standard sigma model. I'm preparing the waters for tomorrow talk of Edward. So take a standard action G bar. So this is just a bosonic sigma model on that space. You could add a B field and. For my purposes, I will use the B field, which has type 1,1. And since this is scalar, you can rewrite this by adding and subtracting terms in the form of the absolute square plus a shifted B field. So B tilde will be something like B plus I G. And now you can rewrite this using in the first order formalism. So this is equivalent. If you integrate out betas, you get back the second order action. And this guy remains. And now take a limit. The GI bar goes to zero, so this is the inverse metric, so which means that it's a large radius. But you keep B tilde finite, which means that the original B field goes to infinity, but along the imaginary direction. So once you've done that, you got rid of this term, and let's suppose that B tilde is actually zero. Then your sigma model looks like it factorizes into the product of one left moving and one right moving first order systems. So you can think of this as a square root, holomorphic square root, of an alpha prime to zero limit. So this is the same as alpha prime to zero. Limit of a sigma model on the Keller manifold with imaginary B field.
So
looks like deriving these non-commutative field theories from string theory, and then you had the closed string metric and the open string metric.
It looks like, in a sense, that you do have an inversion of this G metric, but I'm not talking about the boundary vertex apparatus here. This is the discussion of the bulk of the world sheet. So this system which we are defined here is actually a holomorphic square root of the Siegel model in the limit where it has to trivialize, because there's an alpha prime to zero limit. Well, as always with holomorphic square roots, they might be ill-defined. So what can go wrong? What possibly can go wrong? Well, when you just look at this theory in a given coordinate patch, so you have world sheet, and sort of it lands in a coordinate patch where gammas are good coordinates, then this is just a free field theory. So you have LP. Even put GW to remind you that beta is a 1-0 form. The question arises, what happens when you go from one patch to another patch, when you change coordinates? And in discussing the pure spinners, we will do that, we need that, because the whole point of averaging over all complex, over all pure spinners, is to cover, you know, all possible complex structures on R10, and that means that you have to do some non-trivial transformations, like U goes to U inverse in the example of the ordinary twisters. So what happens when we change coordinates? Well, naively, beta looks like a momentum for gamma, so it has to transform as a one form. So beta has to go to something which we can call beta tilde. You just multiply by a Jacobian. You cannot do that because beta and gamma have a singularity, LP. And here I'm trying to multiply them at the same point. So this is not going to work. We have to normal order it. So we have to point split, for example. Subtract the singular piece, take a limit. Now, once you see this formula, you see that two kinds of troubles can appear. So one is that this procedure depends on the choice of what you call z on the world sheet. So this is, so I'm point splitting in some coordinate on the world sheet. If I do it in different coordinate, the result might be different. So I'm potentially, what may go wrong is that beta will not transform as a primary field of dimension 1-0. Another thing is that even though this formula guarantees that beta tilde with gamma have a canonical OPE, what it does not guarantee is that beta will commute with beta. In general, it will not be non-singular because you have contractions between d gamma here, beta here, and d gamma here, beta here. So you have lots of terms which pop up here, which you need to cancel. And how can you cancel them? Well, your freedom is that you can add to this beta guy something which is constructed out of gamma and its derivatives. So if you just given the fact that this has to look like dimension one field, and you have to add something which will commute with gamma, not to spoil the JOPE, this is what you can do. And so you have some consistency conditions on what you add here, and some of them are satisfied trivially, and some of them are satisfied non-trivially. So in the end, the result is that for passing from one coordinate patch to another, you can always find the correction term. And in fact, the result is kind of nice, actually, that the new kinetic term looks like the old kinetic term plus the Lagrangian of Vesemino-Witten action, where you use the Jacobian of the transformation. It's a matrix field. So it's a Vesemino-Witten for GLD, where D is the complex dimension of X. So you see, this is something which constructed only out of gammas, and locally you can rewrite it as just a correct shift of momentum field data. But the problem is that this action contains something which you all know is the inverse of trace G inverse dG cube. This is not uniquely defined, because you can always add something exact. And the challenge is to find representatives for these d-inverses in such a way that as you go from one patch to another patch back here, you will come back. So it will be consistent. And whether this is possible or not depends on x. And so there's an abstraction.
So far, you're discussing this for any beta gamma.
This is for any curved beta gamma system.
The constraints.
This is for any beta gamma system. The constraints, if you like, in this language, the constraints have been solved. So I've solved the constraints. I parameterized the solution of these constraints by some local coordinates gamma I, and now I'm just discussing the curved beta gamma system. So I should have written this for the pure spinner. The way it works is that you have this. So if you take the ordinary spinner, you have the 16 components, which if you choose some reference complex structure on R10, you can identify them with collections of plus minuses. You have 5 plus minuses with the condition that you have an even number of which you would prefer, pluses. And then the pure spinner constraint relates these components. So the guy with all pluses, sorry, that's not in. So the guy with all minuses can be arbitrary, we call it lambda plus. Then the guy with two pluses somewhere, so this is at the point A, this is at point B, you parameterize as lambda plus times UAB, A less than B. And that's all. That's it, because the remaining guy is expressed in terms of lambda and U, A, B, C, D, in this way. So you can locally parameterize the solution to the pure spinner constraint by 10 complex variables, lambda plus and U, A, B. But you cannot globally do that, because at some point lambda plus may vanish. And then you're hitting the singularity.
Is it 10 or 11 variables?
Overall, you have 11 variables, 1 lambda plus and 10 u's. So in the language, so the difference between these two spaces actually is that here in the blown up space, even when lambda plus vanishes, u still makes sense. So U is a local parameterization of the base. Say again? So when lambda plus equals to zero, you still have this.
What is this manifold? Is it SO10 by SU5?
Yes, it's SO10 by U5.
Yes.
This is a 10-dimensional manifold.
So you're just describing this lambda.
I'm just describing. I'm just saying that.
You said this wrong.
You see, in this space. If I parameterize it that way, if lambda plus vanishes, then everything vanishes. But in this space, if lambda plus vanishes, life still goes on. Just 10 dimensional instead of 10.
So 10 by U5 is the space.
It's the base.
Lambda plus equals zero.
The base, yes.
It's lambda plus equals zero.
All right. So here, when I'm talking about beta gamma, so gamma is this collection lambda plus UAB. in one of the coordinate patches. But then when I go to another patch, there is some transformation which involves rational functions in general. So in general, you get something which is well defined on the triple intersections of the coordinate patches, which is an abstraction for making this whole thing consistent. And this is this abstraction can be traced to be related to the first Pontryagin class of your target space, and this has to be zero, otherwise cannot glue. So you have beta gamma system for every coordinate patch, but you cannot glue them consistently. You cannot define how the operators will transform from one patch to another in a consistent way. And that's the sigmoidal anomaly in this limit. So if you know, this is not unrelated to the famous equation that dH is equal to trace R squared minus trace F squared. So this is the situation where you have no gauge fields, so this is absent, so we said that trace R squared has to be G of something, that's the first Pontryagin class. And this H, which you find there, is what you actually use in defining the Vesemir term. So then you go back and you check whether for this manifold, it's a bit trickier for this manifold since it's non-compact, the actual topological condition is, I mean, you have to actually do it on these coordinate patches to verify what's going on. And it turns out that on this space you have this anomaly which is non-zero. So if you blow up the origin, you cannot glue. This is a bad space. Bad space. So this is why I crossed it out.
But it does satisfy that there's no anomaly.
There is an anomaly.
I'm sorry?
There is another.
So for this space, this space P1 of X is not zero.
It's not zero.
So this is why we cannot use this space.
Is there a simple way to compute this for pedagogic reasons?
Yes, there, well.
But not in particular.
not on two lines.
Not in two lines. I have to. There's some small technology which goes on, which.
I mean, this is an important point, so I think it is important to explain that.
Yes.
But maybe you can also explain that it's important to know what the good space is.
So the only good space. Which
let's go for good space. Come on.
So the good space is a very silly space. It's the space where this point is not there. What it means is that it's the C star bundle. So the good space is the. Oh. Just can't try it. You can't draw it. So the good space, the C star bundle over SO10 over U5. Which means, in practical terms, is that you're allowed to take logarithms of lambda plus. Lambda plus is not allowed to vanish. Or, more precisely, out of 16 components of lambda, at least one is not allowed to vanish. This is what it means.
The non-trivial cohomology of lambda alpha d alpha, is it somehow related to badness? Is there a correlation between non-trivial cohomology of the Kolmogorov operator?
The following is true, that this base, so the base, which is this question, has non-trivial four-dimensional cohomology. In fact, it's just one-dimensional. And this Pontryagin class takes values there, and it's non-trivial. But once you replace it by the C-star bundle over this base, if the first-gen class of the corresponding bundle is appropriate, then you actually kill this cohomology. And this is what happens. You actually kill, so in this space, H4 of the good space is zero. This is not necessary, but it's a bit of overkill in general, because you only need to kill is P1. You don't need to kill all of H4. But in this case, since all of H4 is one-dimensional, you kiloton.
So C star is C this point with the origin removed.
Right.
So there's a two form on the base that squares to this.
Right.
Using that as the first term.
Right. Now, this is not the end of the story, because we have also that remark which I made that this guy, this definition dependent on the choice of the coordinate. So there is another anomaly which has to do with the, well, you can, there are different ways of viewing this, so let me, so after all, we are going to discuss this theory as a conformal field theory, so we better make sure that we have a stress energy tensor. And again, the naive formula for the stress energy tensor, which you just get by looking at this action and then, you know, deforming the complex structure in the worksheet, so you naively would get that the stress energy tensor is beta d gamma. Now, so again, you define it with the point splitting. This definition will suffer.
Epsilon.
Say again? Epsilon goes to zero. And this is epsilon squared.
Right. Okay.
It looks like what?
That looks good.
Good, okay.
Is there a unique way to write the energy movement tensor?
Well, in principle, you could add a total derivative of a stress energy tensor, a derivative of some current. And in fact, this is what
we are basically imposing what the weights are, how the fields transform under. That's
right.
What you're imposing.
No, I mean, so once you define it in one prescription, in this prescription, let's say, that will define how the fields transform.
No, but you could add multiple of derivative of beta gamma, right? That's what we do in physics.
Yes, so this is what I'm saying, that in principle you could add a derivative of some current, but you see, you don't have much freedom here, because gamma has to be dimension zero field, because gamma describes the coordinates on spacetime, which undergo some nonlinear transformations as you go from one coordinate patch to another. If gamma has some spin, the transformations will not be compatible. Which leaves, however, some room for the transformations of beta. Because we saw that beta transforms inhomogeneously as you go from one patch to another. So now with these rules, you can see what will happen as you go from, let's say, from gamma to gamma tilde. Now that I told you how beta transforms, well, it turns out that this guy will pick up some correction, which was like d square of log of determinant of d gamma over d gamma tilde. So z. Has some anomalous correction term. So if you want this to be consistent, then we have to add something here. And as I said, we have to add something which will only contain gammas in order to not to spoil them gamma transformation properties under the conformal transformations. So you need to add some object which will depend on gamma. Let me call it omega of gamma. Which will transform in such a way that as you combine this guy with that guy, you'll get the new guy. So we has to. So instead of that, we need to get g2 log of omega tilde gamma tilde. And
omega, same omega.
The omega omega in the new coordinate system. So the same omega, but in the new coordinate system, it might transform with some. So the omega tilde of gamma tilde has to be omega of all gamma times the determinant d gamma over d gamma tilde to cancel precisely this term. What does it mean? Well, what it means is that your manifold X is such that it has a globally defined holomorphic top degree form. because this determinant precisely means that it's the transformation of that volume form. And also, this form has to be nowhere vanishing, because otherwise you couldn't get logarithm and take a continuous derivative. So this is why you need the manifold to be a Calabi-Yau, this complex Calabi-Yau. So it's a complex manifold with nowhere vanishing holomorphic top degree form. And that's another reason for killing this, for cutting out surgically this zero section, because the top degree form which you can write on this space looks like d10u d lambda plus lambda plus the power 7, I think. So that's a form which is actually invariant under SO10 transformations. And it vanishes big time along the locus lambda plus equals to zero. So lambda plus has to be, so this locus has to be absent. And what now last question is, what does it mean to add to the stress energy tensor this term? It has to come from Lagrangian. So what it means is that this Lagrangian, which I wrote naively as just beta d bar gamma, secretly contains a dilaton term. So there is a it has to contain the term of the form R2 logarithm of the gamma. And what's the significance of this term? Well, it provides a good measure, actually, in the path integral. Because if you work in genus G, so if you just naively count, so if you want to naively define, well, maybe not as naively as Wilson, but in such a way as to please mathematicians, what this path integral means, the only trouble which you face here is the imbalance of the lack of the balance between the number of zero modes. So you have, for each index I, you have one zero mode. This is just a constant. And you have G zero modes for betas, because betas are almost like holomorphic, just one differentials. So zero modes are holomorphic one differentials. You have G holomorphic differentials in genus G. So you need to define a measure for integrating over d gamma 1, d gamma d, so the zero modes of gammas. And G copies zero modes of betas. So these guys, if you have a holomorphic top degree form on the space, you define with omega, and here you need omega inverse to the power g. So overall, you get omega to the power 1 minus g, which is exponential of integral of the Ricci curvature of log omega with coefficient, which I didn't write for technical reasons. So this is why it's all consistent in that sense. All right. Now, once you convince yourself that just the simple consistency conditions require that this space is the C star bundle of SO10 over U5, life gets easier in some sense. Maybe more complicated in other sense, but it gets easier for our original purposes, namely for viewing this as a bullshit action for string theory. Because what we need to define string measure eventually, we need the BRST partner of the stress energy tensor. Well, the stress energy tensor is looking at us, plus this corrected beta d gamma. And q, we know what q is. So q was this lambda alpha d alpha. So in order to write b, we need naively, we need to divide by lambda, because these guys have, if you write in original notations, if you assign a charge plus 1 to lambda and minus 1 to w, the stress energy tensor has charge has charge 0, and q has charge 1. So b has to be of charge minus 1. And naively, you have to construct it using w, but w itself is not gauge invariant. You can add to it something which is proportional to lambda, and it will vanish because of the pure spin constraint. So if you want to write an expression for B, it will have to involve something like 1 over lambda, at least some of component lambda, of lambda. And then the whole, and so if our space was this, we would not be able to write that, because lambda would vanish somewhere, and this will be singular. But on this space, where at least 1 lambda alpha is not 0, this is possible. So you choose this alpha for which this is non-zero, and that gives you a local expression for this ghost field B. It's local in terms of it's local on this pure spinner space. And then I'm out of time, because then the story gets more interesting. So you get a local expression for B ghost. Sorry, so I did get to Chen Simons and Jan Mills. I'll be here next week. Was it sufficiently non-technical? Thanks.